From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the results of a 15-year study of elderly nuns examining the causes, symptoms, and progression of Alzheimer's disease. We talk with epidemiologist Dr. David Snowden. His study just made the front page of the New York Times and the cover of Time magazine. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg on anachronistic expressions. He's noticed phrases appearing in movies that weren't even in use back when the movie is set. And Kevin Whitehead continues his series Avant-Garde Made Easy with the music of saxophonist Albert Eiler. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Congressional leaders and White House officials have been negotiating intensely today, trying to pull together enough votes to pass a budget compromise. NPR's David Wellen has been watching this process all day. David, the House was expecting to be able to pass the budget tomorrow morning. Does that still appear likely?
Well, Corey, they can pass it tomorrow if there's a budget to vote on, and that's been a big issue ever since the previous attempt to pass the budget fell apart last Friday in the wee hours when the vote was called off because two pages of the budget were allegedly omitted. GOP leaders are now saying that they have enough votes in the evenly divided Senate to get the budget passed, so it looks like a deal has been worked out with a few centrist senators and things can proceed in the House since both the House and the Senate have to approve the exact same budget.
Now, this budget is non-binding, after all. Why has it become such a difficult issue?
Well, for Democrats, the budget has been a test of their force in the Senate versus that of President Bush, so there's been a symbolic battle of wills. And for Republicans, the budget is vital because it provides crucial protection for the $1.35 trillion tax cut that's in the budget. It means Democrats can't stop it with a filibuster.
Thank you. NPR's congressional correspondent, David Wilner. The managers of California's power grid have ordered more rolling blackouts. Officials have asked the state's private utilities to cut enough power for 300,000 homes for at least 2 hours. A spokeswoman for the independent system operator said hot temperatures drove up demand for air conditioning and drained the state's power reserves. She said it's also been difficult to get enough power from out-of-state suppliers. The spokeswoman said power shortages could be a problem all week because of continued forecasts for high temperatures. A new study says that special programs for low-income children can improve school performance and reduce arrest rates. The report comes from the latest edition of the Journal of the American Medical Association. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
The study looked at nearly 1,000 children who went through the Chicago Child Parent Center, an early intervention program that offers enriched pre-K and family services. The study followed children into adulthood and found that kids who went through this program were more likely to finish high school and less likely to be arrested than their peers. Participants were also less likely to need expensive special education services. The Chicago program offers kids additional services through age 9, and the study found kids who stayed in the program longest were the most successful. Supporters say this research provides more evidence of the need to improve the nation's largest early intervention program, Head Start, which offers similar services to nearly 1 million low-income kids. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Chicago.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 51 points to close at 10,883 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq gained 24 points to close at 2,198. This is NPR News. Pope John Paul II ended his 3-day visit to Syria today with another appeal to Middle East leaders. The pontiff called for an end to violence. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports from Damascus.
At the airport farewell ceremony, John Paul said he shall cherish the memory of his visit to the Umayyad Mosque, the first time a pontiff has entered an Islamic place of worship. He also voiced the hope that Syria's long tradition of harmony between Christians and Muslims will endure and become even stronger. Turning to the regional political conflict, the Pope said that fundamental issues of truth and justice, of rights and responsibilities, must be resolved for peace to be achieved. John Paul said a solution is possible within the framework of international law and UN resolutions, and he appealed to all the leaders of the region to recognize that confrontation has failed and will always fail. In his response, President Bashar al-Assad thanked the Pope for his visit and reiterated his government's strong anti-Israeli stance. Sylvia Poggioli, NPR News, Damascus.
China is protesting the resumption of U.S. surveillance flights off its coast. A foreign ministry spokesman said China would lodge serious protests over the flights, which began again yesterday with the flight of an unarmed Air Force RC-135 along China's northeastern coast. Chinese officials also said that Beijing will not allow a U.S. Navy surveillance plane to fly home from Hainan Island. The Chinese have held the plane since April 1st, when it was forced to land after colliding with a Chinese fighter jet. Civilian technicians from Lockheed Martin examined the plane last week and said it could be repaired on the site and flown to Okinawa. The other option is to partially dismantle the plane and ship it home in pieces. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, saluting cultural programming on NPR, recipient of the Year 2000 National Medal of Arts.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dr. David Snowden, is an epidemiologist who has just published the initial results of his 15-year study of the symptoms, causes, and progression of Alzheimer's disease. The results made the front page of the New York Times yesterday and the cover of Time magazine. The focus of Snowden's study was a group of 678 elderly nuns. He chose to study nuns because they live carefully regulated lives, and that reduces the variables of the study. Over the past 15 years, Dr. Snowden repeatedly tested the nuns' short-term memories, measuring the amount of memory loss they experienced over time. He administered various other mental and physical tests, and after the deaths of nuns who had given their permission, he performed autopsies on their brains. In the new book, Aging with Grace, Dr. Snowden discusses his study and what it can tell us about the mysteries of Alzheimer's disease. One of Dr. Snowden's more interesting findings came from studying the autobiographical essays each nun was required to write when she joined the order. He found these personal histories in the convent archive. I asked what the nuns' essays enabled him to study.
Well, this really gave us a window into their early life, their early family life, characteristics of their parents, kind of their personal orientation, and more specifically, just their ability to handle language, their ability to express themselves. And that was really one of our first kind of insights that we could see, that sisters with not much content in the autobiography, that they tended to be at high risk 60 years later for the pathology of Alzheimer's in the brain as well as the symptoms. And so, again, kind of tapping both probably language and short-term memory very early on in life.
You started to ask some really interesting questions, such as, do grammatically complex sentences with lots of embedded clauses predict that you are any less likely to get Alzheimer's? And if your sentences are really simple, does that mean you're more likely to get Alzheimer's? What led you to even ask this question?
Well, about a dozen years ago, I was in the library and I found an article on short-term memory testing in college freshmen. And they found that the college freshmen who could write grammatically complex sentences, they tended to score very high on what's called working memory, which is what just happened seconds ago. And it makes sense. In order to complete a complicated, idea-dense sentence, you've got to remember what you just did a few seconds ago for it all to hang together. And so this one particular study showed that the short-term memory and the ability to pack a lot of ideas in a sentence was highly correlated in college freshmen, and I thought that was might give us a window into, to some extent, their short-term memory abilities as well as other cognitive abilities.
What did you find when studying the grammar and the complexity of the sentences in these early autobiographies that the nuns wrote?
Well, we found that grammatical complexity had a correlation with mental function, but the most striking finding was that the amount of ideas that they could pack into a sentence was strongly correlated with a very very low risk of Alzheimer's disease and very low amount of Alzheimer's pathology. So it wasn't that you necessarily had to do verbal gymnastics. It's just, could you get across a lot of ideas?
You reprint a sentence from the nun with the highest idea density and grammatical complexity and the nun with the lowest idea density and grammatical complexity. So let me compare them. This is the nun with the lowest idea density and grammatical complexity. She wrote, My father, Mr. L. M. Halliker, was born in the city of Ross, County Cork, Ireland, and is now a sheet metal worker in Eau Claire. And here's the sister with the highest idea density and grammatical complexity. My father is an all-around man of trades, but his principal occupation is carpentry, which trade he had already begun before his marriage with my mother. Now, what kind of outcome do both of these women have in terms of their memory?
Well, the sister with the low idea density, who is really kind of monotone, very linear in her description of her father, developed Alzheimer's, both in her brain. She had the pathology, and she had very severe symptoms. The sister with very high idea density, who was really kind of speaking almost in high fidelity, she had very, very high mental function, and, you know, she's still alive. We haven't looked at her brain yet. So it's really kind of the difference between writing in monotone, kind of linear listing of facts to this high fidelity where you've got ideas that are interconnected with each other. I mean, to some extent, it's also maybe marking how interconnected the brain is and how well-developed the brain is.
Well, as you point out in your study, there has for a long time been thought to be a link between education and Alzheimer's. The more educated you are, the less likely you are to get the disease. But then the chicken and egg question comes in. Is it that you are more likely to comprehend the education if you have the kind of mind that isn't prone to Alzheimer's, or is it the education is actually preventing Alzheimer's?
You're right. I would lean toward that those with really good mental abilities, with good language abilities, good short-term memory in early life, have that's marking very, very well-developed brains, and that brain tissue during the next five decades or so, or six decades, would be more resistant to the growth of the lesions of Alzheimer's in the brain. And so it's clear that, I mean, from our, not just our work, but from many other studies now, that Alzheimer's is a lifelong disease process, and that there are changes in the brain going on before the symptoms show up. So Alzheimer's is going to be like cancer and heart disease and stroke, that one has to take a lifelong, long view of it and not be concerned about it only when you're old, but throughout your life.
But for now, your theory is the more that you engage with your brain, the more you use your brain for complex things, the less likely you are to get the symptoms of Alzheimer's?
Right. And the earlier you start, the better, because people tend to track at a certain ranking. If you have high blood pressure or high language ability when you're a young child, you're likely to be that high ranking when you're in middle age and old age. So I think Alzheimer's is going to end up being like coronary heart disease. It really wasn't until the Korean War that young men were dying who were very healthy that the surgeons could see that they already had the hardening of the arteries, the atherosclerotic plaques that were developing. And now we know that the atherosclerotic plaques of leading to heart disease and stroke are actually occurring in infancy. And I think the same thing now is happening in Alzheimer's, that we're tracking back decades and decades. And brain autopsy studies done in Germany show that the classic lesions or protein deposits of Alzheimer's are occurring in people as young as 20.
You convinced the nuns to donate their brains after death for examination. One of the things you did, you know, with the neurologist you were working with, one of the things that you did with these brains after death was to weigh them. What does it tell you to weigh a brain?
Well, it's been known by pathologists for decades that, at least for an adult female brain, that if it weighs less than 1,000 grams, or about 2.25 pounds, that would mean that it's a high likelihood that it's Alzheimer's. Because basically Alzheimer's destroys the tissue and it shrinks the brain. That's what causes Alzheimer's. It's actual damage and destruction of the brain. So something as simple as weighing the brain can give you a pretty high indication of whether there's been a lot of pathology. And certainly scanning the brain and looking at the actual damage at the microscopic level can tell you even more about how much damage has occurred.
Were there any surprising findings in weighing the brains?
Well, we had one sister that we called Sister Mary, who was the first centenarian to die in the study. And I knew her, and she was really a remarkable person from our Baltimore province of the convent. And when we When she died, when we looked at her brain, we were surprised that it was about 800 grams. So she was really a very, very light brain and should have had Alzheimer's disease, but in fact she had no symptoms and was really quite a remarkable statement for even when the pathology is present in the brain, that some of these sisters, and we know from other studies, other people can resist showing the expression of the symptoms. So it's kind of like a study. She's in many ways kind of like studying people who have been in a car accident. And if you just studied people who died in the car, or in this case got the symptoms of Alzheimer's, you might come to certain conclusions. But she's someone who actually was, if you will, kind of in a car accident but walked away and really didn't hardly have a scratch. So I think in a lot of ways that's very hopeful that even when the pathology is present, that even when the genes are present, that there are some of the sisters in our study and other studies who resist showing the symptoms. And that's good news for all of us.
Something else that you were looking for is what connection is there between the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease and stroke? So tell us the correlation you found between Alzheimer's disease and stroke.
Well, ever since Dr. Alzheimer's first described Alzheimer's disease in a 52-year-old patient at the beginning of last century, it's been an issue about whether strokes and hardening of the arteries in the brain might be playing a role. And in fact, in the 50s and 60s in the United States, Alzheimer's was called hardening of the arteries. More recently in the last several years, the importance of strokes and even heart disease and the health of the blood vessels has become very important as a contributing cause to Alzheimer's disease. And basically what we found is when we look at, we looked at 102 sisters, all of whom were teachers and had a bachelor's degree or higher, that we had autopsies on. And we found that those sisters who had an Alzheimer's brain, and stroke, particularly small strokes, that they had the combination of an Alzheimer's brain and small strokes in strategic regions of the brain, that they had a very, very high risk of showing the symptoms. Now, the sisters who had just an Alzheimer's brain and were stroke-free had a dramatically reduced risk of showing the symptoms. So stroke, among other things, may be a trigger that may push an Alzheimer's brain over the edge. Head trauma is another thing. Head injuries may be another factor that will trigger or push an Alzheimer's brain over the edge to where you will show the symptoms. Depression, there's a variety of factors.
So part of your advice is do whatever you can to reduce the possibility of stroke.
Reduce the possibility of stroke, reduce the risk of head trauma, something as simple as buckling your seatbelt, eat a prudent diet, not smoke. I mean, when you're a child, you want in the ideal, parents and grandparents and family friends and teachers would help you develop your brain and mind to its optimal ability. But after that point, you really have to maintain whatever function you've got. And there's because the brain can basically handle a lot of disease and destruction before it starts to show symptoms. It's got great resilience and adaptive abilities, but you can't overwhelm it. It's very easy to make Alzheimer's worse. It's hard to treat it. It's hard to make it better.
How do you make it worse?
Well, I mean, certainly depression, stroke, a confusing environment can make it worse. Poor diet, medication problems. The way the healthcare system is now, you almost really need a patient advocate. And that's one of the things with the sisters in some of the convents, they've had to place them in nursing homes. And they actually have a sister who is a full-time sister-patient advocate who is always trying to optimize the environment and the healthcare, and whether it's trying to keep the noise level down, trying to give an Alzheimer's patient visual reminders. The visual part of the brain visual memory is much more longer lasting. So, for example, if you had an Alzheimer's patient who wanted to talk to his brother, or the brother wanted to talk to him, something as simple as putting a picture of the brother by the phone might help the patient realize who they're talking to, because the visual part of memory goes much later than just the use of words.
My guest is Dr. David Snowden. His new book is called Aging with Grace. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is epidemiologist Dr. David Snowden. For the past 15 years, he's been studying a group of elderly nuns looking for clues to the mysteries of Alzheimer's disease, like who is most likely to get it and why. He's just written a book about the study called Aging with Grace. Another clue that you were investigating is depression. Is depression linked with Alzheimer's disease? How did you investigate that question?
Well, this has been looked at for decades, and it's always another kind of chicken or egg proposition that did the person develop the symptoms of Alzheimer's and then become depressed over it, or did the depression predate the development of the symptoms of Alzheimer's? And recent brain studies are now starting to show that this region of the brain called the hippocampus, which is damaged and shrinks in Alzheimer's, that the hippocampus also may shrink in depression. And that, again, may go back to early life influences. But probably with depression and Alzheimer's, the arrows go both ways, that depression can increase the age at onset, but Alzheimer's itself probably can increase the depression. About a quarter of Alzheimer's patients have untreated depression. And this is, again, another simple way of trying to make life easier for someone with Alzheimer's, just simply treating their depression.
How did you measure for depression in your study?
Well, we have a list of questions. I mean, they're very kind of classic symptoms of crying and sleeping problems. And in fact, you know, I think our sense is that while some of the nuns do have depression, that we think there's probably a low prevalence of depression in our population. It's not easy for a nun to get away with sleeping all day or crying. It's just not part of the culture. But there may be other ways in which it's expressed. But depression is a big-time problem for the rest of the older population, in particular women, that is treatable.
So what are the findings from your study that you think will be most important in our future knowledge of Alzheimer's disease?
Well, I think number one is that whether it be the education findings or the linguistic findings, as well as other studies that are looking at early life factors, that one wants to develop that brain to its fullest capacity, the language ability, reading ability, memory ability. And so we want to develop it, the brain and the mind, to its optimal level in early childhood, probably particularly during the first few years of life, even before you get to school. Language acquisition is extremely important. But once you become an adult, then I think you want to follow a prudent lifestyle, be it exercise, not smoking, keeping mentally active. You want to basically maintain that level. It's not really so much use it or lose it. It's develop it and keep it. And even in old age, when impairments do start to develop, one wants to try to just work with what you've got. I mean, I was at the convent last week, and one of my friends there, Sister Nicolette, she always goes up several times a day to see her sibling, who also is a nun, Sister Ursula. And Ursula has got the symptoms of Alzheimer's, and Nicolette goes up there very patiently and quizzes her every several times a day about what's the day, and has her go through stories from their childhood, and tries to work with what she's got. It's very easy when you have Alzheimer's to just withdraw. Alzheimer's is not a disease that you suffer in silence and that you're in some kind of bliss that you don't know what's happening to you. For years, you know very well what's happening to you. And it's easy for an Alzheimer's patient to kind of withdraw and not say anything because they can kind of embarrass themselves because they have a hard time remembering what was just said.
Were there any foods, vitamins, or supplements that you found to be useful in preventing or slowing Alzheimer's? And are there any vitamins or supplements that have been discussed in that context that you found really weren't doing anything at all?
Well, there's been a lot of interest in vitamin E and the antioxidants in Alzheimer's disease, and there are some studies that suggest that vitamin E intake and other antioxidant intake may reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease. To some extent, the jury is still out on that question. On the other hand, there's other good reasons to take vitamin E. And in our study, we were surprised and disheartened to see that we couldn't see vitamin E's level in the blood related to the symptoms. What we did see is we replicated a study that was done in Oxford, where we could see that sisters who had high folic acid levels in their blood, a vitamin found in leafy green vegetables like spinach as well as in multivitamin pills, we could see that those who had high folic acid, that they had less damage to the brain. Even when they had an Alzheimer's brain, that there was less damage or shrinkage of the brain. And I think in a lot of ways, I'm sure that there'll be other nutrients that'll be found to be important, because Alzheimer's is a brain-wasting disease, and it makes sense that probably the last thing you want to do is nutritionally deprive your brain when it's under a brain-wasting condition. And there may be specific nutrients like folic acid, maybe vitamin E, and probably others that may help to fortify the tissue against destruction. And folic acid makes sense because it's important in the development of the spinal cord and the brain during the during fetal development. So folic acid, and I'm sure other nutrients, may be important to both the development of the brain tissue and its maintenance throughout life.
Have you been taking folic acid supplements since doing the study?
I take, you know, multivitamin pills. I'll take one on one day, and on alternative days I'll take two. So I get, you know, about maybe 50% more. More importantly, I try to eat as much fruits and vegetables as I can, because I'm absolutely convinced there'll be many other factors that are found in plants that will have protective value against Alzheimer's and stroke and other diseases. And so, you know, while the scientists wrestle with, is it folic acid, is it vitamin E, by eating fruits and vegetables, you tend to, it's kind of like investing in a mutual fund. You've got lots of different nutrients there. You know, some multivitamin pills and lots of fruits and vegetables is just, I think, a good overall general health practice.
Dr. David Snowden's new book about the Nunn study and Alzheimer's disease is called Aging with Grace. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Holland America, offering cruises to destinations worldwide, including the Caribbean, the Panama Canal, Alaska, and Europe. On the web at hollandamerica.com. And Random House Incorporated's Crown Publishing Group Division, publishers of The Elements of Journalism, What News People Should Know and the Public Should Expect by Bill Kovich and Tom Rosensteel. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with Dr. David Snowden on what the Nunn study tells us about the causes and symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg on words and expressions that only recently entered our vocabulary. And Kevin Whitehead considers the music of saxophonist Albert Eiler as his Avant-Garde Made Easy series continues.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with epidemiologist Dr. David Snowden. He's just published the results of his study of the symptoms, causes, and progression of Alzheimer's disease. His study is based on tracking 678 elderly nuns over the course of 15 years, testing their short-term memories at regular intervals, administering other mental and physical tests, and autopsying the brains of nuns who died. His new book about his study is called Aging with Grace. There's been some speculation that for women, estrogen might help stave off Alzheimer's disease, and that's been one of the arguments for taking hormone replacement therapy
yes.
after menopause. Did you investigate that and reach any conclusions?
The sisters really aren't of the generation that would have taken estrogen during menopause, and so we have not directly looked at that, but you know, unfortunately, to our disappointment and scientists probably throughout the world, the evidence on estrogen protecting against Alzheimer's has really been weakened over the last several years. I think it's pretty well accepted now that that taking estrogen replacement, estrogen pills in Alzheimer's patients does not slow down the development of the symptoms in patients who have Alzheimer's. The jury still is out on whether Alzheimer's the onset of the symptoms, the first onset, might be delayed by estrogen. So it's the Women's Health Initiative, which the National Institute of Health is conducting, which will give us, I think, the best evidence of whether taking estrogens may postpone. There's good biologic reasons to think that estrogens should protect the brain tissue as well as other tissue from destruction, but we're all of us, I think, are pretty disappointed that the evidence for estrogen is starting to weaken. I mean, I think what happened over years ago is that very, very smart women who were very well-read, who had really good minds and short-term memory and were good thinkers, they were the very ones who asked their doctors about estrogen. So it kind of got confounded that smart women years ago probably were the ones who were predominantly taking the estrogen and something else was protecting them from Alzheimer's, their smartness, and rather than the estrogen. So,
because of all the tests you were administering over this 15-year period, you were able to see the gradual development of Alzheimer's disease in some of the nuns. Would you tell them, look, looks like you're developing Alzheimer's disease?
Boy, that's a tough one. And we wrestle with that every day. And we are now in the process of talking to the sisters and their leaders about what information can we share that might help identify people in the early phases of Alzheimer's. Because once you get Alzheimer's symptoms, you know, there may be some small things that can be done, but the real hope in Alzheimer's is trying to identify people at very high risk when they don't have symptoms, and either drugs or nutrition or other things that could be done for them so that they protect the brain and they don't get the damage. We certainly, these are very dear women, and we don't want to withhold any information from them, but we also get very concerned about if we tell them they are at high risk, what will happen to them? I mean, one of the sisters that become a dear friend over the last several years, she was falsely diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And for 2 years, she thought that she had Alzheimer's. And every time she couldn't remember someone's name, she kind of beat herself up. And the sisters around her kind of dealt with her differently. It's not like telling someone that they have a high risk of heart disease or colon cancer. You're talking about the brain, and that's what makes us who we are, our ability to touch and communicate and love other people is encoded there, our very personality. That's what makes Alzheimer's such a devastating disease, but that's also the other part of the double-edged sword that makes it difficult to do early intervention because you can label people and can be tough going. So we think we have a really good chance with the nuns because we want to work with them, and there's some really smart sisters there who hopefully will help us deal with doing early intervention and trying to make information useful to them.
So does this mean you didn't tell the nuns who you suspected were in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease?
That's correct. We did. Those sisters that we can see, I mean, it's really in the last, even in the last 12 months, that we now can see in our study that the sisters who have a short-term memory problem have very, very high risk of developing full-blown dementia within 5 to 10 years. And it's taken us, you know, 10, 15 years to get to that point. But now we have pretty much overwhelming evidence based on the sisters that the presence of a memory impairment, short-term memory impairment, is highly predictive. A study done a couple weeks ago that was released showed from St. Louis, Washington University, showed very much the same thing, that the patients in their study that they followed over the years, that if they had a memory impairment, that I think something where 80 to 90% of them ultimately developed dementia. So we're now starting to see that short-term memory problems aren't just benign forgetfulness or kind of something that comes with aging, that it's more and more scientists and clinicians are believing that short-term memory problems are not normal in the aging, and that that's a bellwether of impending dementia, and particularly Alzheimer's disease.
Dr. David Snowden is my guest. He's an epidemiologist, and for the past 15 years, he's been studying a group of elderly nuns, looking for clues to the mysteries of Alzheimer's disease, who's most likely to get it, and why. He's just written a book about the study called Aging with Grace. One of the things that all the nuns in your study have in common is that they live in a community of prayer and reflection, which most of us don't. And I'm wondering if you think that that connects at all to the fact that a lot of the nuns who you studied lived to a much older age than the average age in America. And I don't know how the percentage of Alzheimer's compared to the larger population.
Well, the sisters definitely live longer. We suspect that they are at slightly lower risk of Alzheimer's. They may get the symptoms later. But I think the big thing is that my personal view of this is that their spiritual life, and I think as important is the community that they live in, the social support, the friendship, that does a lot to promote the quality of life and the length of life. Imagine for yourself that you actually would end up retiring and you could be surrounded by people that you went to high school and college with, that you worked for 50 years with. In 20% of the cases, you'd have a sibling who was down the hall, who also was, in this case, a nun. But to actually retire in a situation where you're surrounded by your friends who knew you 50, 60, 70 years is a phenomenal opportunity. I think that's clearly one thing that I've taken away, that I really give a lot of thought to. How am I going to live in my old age? It's not just about mental fitness and physical fitness, which, you know, we're studying. The social component, the spiritual component is, I think, very, very important. And, I'm convinced that it leads to a longer life and a better life.
My guest is Dr. David Snowden. His new book is called Aging with Grace. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is epidemiologist Dr. David Snowden. For the past 15 years, he's been studying a group of elderly nuns, looking for clues to the mysteries of Alzheimer's disease, who's most likely to get it and why. He's just written a book about the study called Aging with Grace. Did doing the study make you any more or less scared about your old age?
I'm a little more concerned about it now. I'd say that my biggest concern is the social part. You know, every day I try to exercise, I try to eat well. So I'm doing the things for keeping my mental and physical health. I'm a bachelor and I'm thinking, boy, I got to get busy here. Cause I, you know, I want to have that community life, that warm, you know, human relations that were what it's all about. That's clearly one of the things that we've never studied that has had the greatest personal impact on me, the importance of being surrounded, probably at any age, but particularly at old age, by the people that love you. I mean, old age can be a time of great promise, and I want that. I want a little piece of that for myself. So I guess I better get busy dating.
Don't divorce, though, because it'll ruin the whole experiment. you've done previous studies with religious orders investigating health. What were those studies about?
Well, I got my start studying Lutherans in Minnesota, of all places, looking at diet and cancer in Lutherans. And after I finished my PhD, I went out to Loma Linda Medical College out in Southern California and was involved in some large studies of Seventh-day Adventists, who many of them are vegetarians and they don't smoke or drink. And we were looking at dietary components of the long life and low cancer risk in the Seventh-day Adventists. And that's really where the light bulb went on in my head, that studying religious groups, particularly for a population scientist, that's what an epidemiologist really is. We're a population scientist. And we would rather work with a population that's already been identified and enumerated, because we don't want to just study sick people. We also want to study healthy people. So when I came back to Minnesota, I decided that I was, you know, pretty convinced of studying religious populations was a good choice. And then when I stumbled into the archives at the convent, then I realized not only were they identified, but you could trace them back 60, 70 years, and that you could see the sisters who had a worse outcome than, say, getting a disability when they're 80 or 90, that we could also study sisters who had a worse outcome that they died when they were 20 or 30. Because aging really is it's a lifelong process. It's a telescopic process throughout the whole life. And those convent archives offered us a window into their early and midlife.
You're proud that you were able to get to know many of the nuns who you've studied. Problem is that some of them developed Alzheimer's disease and they would forget you because of the disease. That must have been very upsetting.
Well, that's the hardest part of all this. When they die, I feel sad for myself that I'm not going to be able to spend time with them anymore, but it's pretty short-lived. What's hard, though, is I'm sure other family members of Alzheimer's patients feel this, is that when you see them start to lose themselves, that's very difficult, and particularly trying to gauge whether they know, you know, how much of their personality and their essence of their being is still there. One of my favorite sisters, Sister DeBrito, a few days ago had her 90th birthday. And over the 15 years that I've known her, particularly the last 5 years, I've seen a real loss in function. And a couple years ago, she could kind of get my name out. And then maybe a year ago, she physically acted as if she recognized me. And I can occasionally now get a smile out of her. But that's the hard part, and particularly not knowing. And that's the language component, the communication part of this. And you never will know. I mean, you'll never know if how much of their essence is still there, regardless of whether they can communicate. The main thing is you just never want to assume that they're gone. That just I'm convinced through several incidents that you'll just never know.
Give me an example of one of those incidents that gives you that impression.
Well, Valentine's Day several years ago, we were in the Milwaukee convent and we're giving out Valentines. And I remember walking down the hallway and there was a sister in full habit who was sitting in a wheelchair. And I came up to her and she was kind of articulating kind of a word soup. There were words that I could understand what the words meant, but they were not threaded together in any coherent way that at least that I could understand. And I took the Valentine out, and I showed her the envelope, and it said Center on Aging, University of Kentucky. And I pointed at it, and I said, this is where I'm from. And the building I was in at the time, the convent, probably had about 200 nuns in it. So I pointed at the envelope and said, Sister, this is where I'm from, the Center on Aging. And she stopped her babbling, and she clearly said, no, this is the Center on Aging. She laughed and then immediately went back to her babbling. And she had her, you know, her moment there. And I'm absolutely convinced. I've seen other evidence, you know, since then that you just never know. And that's kind of the heartbreaking part, but that's why you never want to treat someone with Alzheimer's or as if they're children or they're dumb or whatever. You want to treat them with respect because you'll never know. And she was the first one who taught me that lesson. And, you know, with a joke.
Well, Dr. Snowden, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. David Snowden's new book about the nun study and Alzheimer's disease is called Aging with Grace. When we watch a period film, we're usually quick to spot an object, an item of clothing, or a hairstyle that doesn't fit with the period. But linguist Jeff Nunberg says linguistic anachronisms are sometimes more difficult to detect.
Umberto Eco's novel, The Island of the Day Before, is a tale of a 17th-century Italian who's marooned on a wrecked ship. When Eco started the novel, he decided that he would only use nautical terms that were current in that period, and he insisted that his translators do likewise when they rendered the story into other languages. The exercise was only for his personal satisfaction, of course. Most readers wouldn't have blinked an eye if Eco had stuck a poop deck on his 17th-century vessel, even if it turns out that the phrase didn't appear until 200 years later. But linguistic anachronisms can be hard to spot even when the time period is a lot more recent. The other night I rented Almost Famous, Cameron Crowe's autobiographical movie about a teenaged rock journalist touring with a band in the early 70s. The movie opens with a couple of scenes set in 1969, when the hero is 11 and living in a San Diego suburb. At one point, his mother says to his sister, "Don't be such a drama queen." It struck me that that was about 15 years too early for that phrase, and when I checked, it turned out that drama queen didn't appear in print until 1987. The phrase was probably in use in gay circles earlier than that, but it certainly wasn't the kind of thing that a straight suburban mother would have called her daughter in 1969. And I had the same reaction when the mother uses finger quotes around a word. Nobody was doing that in the 60s either. Granted, the anachronisms probably didn't trouble many moviegoers, no more than I would have been bothered to discover a poop deck on Eco's 17th-century ship. For that matter, most of the people in the movie's target audience wouldn't know who Humble Pie was without a footnote. But it does point up how hard it is to remember when we started to talk the way we do. Here's an item for Regis Philbin to use to screen contestants for Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. List the following four phrases in the order in which they first appeared in the language. A, put it on the back burner. B, counterproductive. C, out of the loop. D, hard news. Okay, here are the answers in the correct order. Hard news first appeared in print in 1948. Counterproductive was in vogue in 1961. Put it on the back burner started to pop up in 1975. And out of the loop first showed up in 1983. Those dates are only approximate, since dictionaries don't usually nail down the very first occurrence of a word. But the fact is that I wouldn't have guessed any of them within a decade. It's an odd feeling when you can't remember when you started using a word. It's like forgetting how you used to think. A while ago, I was talking to a friend who was writing an article about her discovery of American Jewish writers when she was a college student in the 1950s. She kept finding herself using terms like WASP and ethnic, only to realize that those words hadn't figured in her psyche in the period she was talking about. In fact, WASP didn't come into the language until the early 1960s. In the end, she decided to use the anachronisms, along with qualifiers like, as we would now call them. It wasn't just that she had trouble recalling the words she used to use, but that they wouldn't have meant much to her now. That conversation came to mind when I was watching a later scene in Almost Famous, this one set in 1973. The members of the band are in a plane that looks as if it's about to crash, and they start to exchange confessions. The manager confesses that he took a few extra dollars, and one of the band members says that he slept with another member's wife. And then, in what's supposed to be the capper, one of them announces, "I'm gay." It's a good line, but it isn't the way anybody would have come out of the closet back then, when gay was still a few years off from being a mainstream word. But then, what other word could Crow have used here? Before gay came into the language, there wasn't any way for a mainstream movie to refer to homosexuals in a familiar and sympathetic way. It wasn't just the word that was anachronistic, but the scene. There was no way you could have played it as a comedy if the movie had been made in 1973. That's why we can forgive Blake Edwards when he had characters describing themselves as gay in his movie Victor Victoria, even though that was set in the 1930s. That wasn't how it was, of course, but maybe it's the way it should have been. Sometimes the past makes more sense speaking in anachronisms than it does in its own words.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Coming up, Avant-Garde Made Easy. This is Fresh Air. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead is playing and discussing the music of a half dozen modern jazz mavericks in his series Avant-Garde Made Easy. Today in part five, saxophonist Albert Eiler. He was born in Cleveland in 1935 and began recording in 1962. 8 years later, he was an apparent murder victim, his body dredged from New York's East River. During those 8 years, Eiler recorded unorthodox versions of standards, respectful readings of spirituals, early jazz rock records, and some of the most radical free jazz ever. His fans included John Coltrane, whose own late recordings reflect Eiler's influence. This is Eiler's most famous composition, Ghosts.
No one in jazz was as far out and far in as Albert Eiler. Far out in terms of how he improvised. Far in terms of the songs he wrote to improvise on. They sounded like a jumble of bugle calls, national anthems, nursery rhymes, and drinking songs. Tenor saxophonist Albert Eiler with his trumpet-playing brother Donald, a frequent collaborator. Music ran in the family. As a boy, Albert had studied music and listened to jazz with his father. They'd also played saxophone duets in church. As a memento, Albert later recorded an album of spirituals. Gospel saxophonists typically use a wide vibrato to make their sound more voice-like and unworldly. Eiler took that lesson to heart. His exaggerated vibrato also echoes old New Orleans jazz musicians when they'd play spirituals. Trumpeter Kid Howard and clarinetist George Lewis. Albert Eiler also liked slow drag tempos, but he'd stretch time even further. He stretched everything, time, pitch, and the very fabric of a saxophone sound. Once Eiler had developed that sound, the problem was deciding what went with it, what context might be suitable for it. In Denmark in 1963, he made a perversely memorable record of standards with a straight local rhythm section. Big mistake. Worlds in collision. What Eiler needed was a band that could stretch time and tonality the way he did. In 1964, he led a trio which remains one of the great radical jazz groups. Like their boss, bassist Gary Peacock and drummer Sonny Murray stretched the roles of their instruments almost to the breaking point. The trio's music has an intensity and fervor that are hard to match. But it had shape, too. Eiler's tunes have such clear outlines. Even a suggestion of the melody yokes the improvising to the material. ¶¶ Albert Ayler's folksy tunes and abstract improvising may seem contradictory, but you could trace both to his church upbringing. He always saw music as having a spiritual dimension. Think of his meandering solos on basic tunes as a kind of meditation on sacred texts, or speaking in tongues, to use an analogy writers invoked in the 1960s. As for his plain-spoken melodies, with titles like Spirits Rejoice, Holy Holy, and A Little Prayer, it helps to remember that bugle calls, national anthems, nursery rhymes, and drinking songs are all designed to bring people together. Prayer, testifying, and fostering a sense of community are what Ayler's music as well as church-going is about. In that light, even his amusingly misguided jazz rock records of the late 60s make sense, reflecting his ecumenical vision and will to reach everyone. Albert Ayler's raucous sound and populist leanings may give cultural conservatives the blues, but his initiatives were always faith-based.
Kevin Whitehead is based in Chicago. For more on his series, go to our website, freshair.com. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Incorporated's Dell Trade Paperback Division, publisher of The Greatest Generation by Tom Brokaw, available in paperback. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about that famous drum line with the musician who played it, Hal Blaine, one of the greatest session drummers in rock and roll history. Also, former Boston Celtics star Bill Russell discusses his illustrious basketball career. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.